from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South.
Now, this transformation was more than a little disconcerting. I had gotten used to the other Brian, the one who had been emanating profound terror and fear of the unknown. We emptied the water out of the canoe, got back in it, and proceeded, wet, on down the river. After about 10 minutes, Brian turned around and looked at me. A big smile emerged from the previously terrified kid, and he said, "Can we do that again tomorrow?"
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Criminal hotspots were suitable for cheer teams, but certainly not much else, according to this policeman. That's when I saw it, out the window down in the parking lot, a girl getting arrested. I closed the blinds and stepped back into the room. This wasn't my business. I grabbed the camera. This was everybody's business.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
So I left my standing place and companions, even a bit unwilling to completely suppress ego, mentally reviewing the relationship of step to beat, movement to rhythm. Within six steps, I truly didn't care. I stepped in behind a short gray-haired man with a ponytail, a red shirt, and a waving umbrella, and I began my best imitation of the Addams Family butler.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Starting now, our love has ended. I'm tired of pretending it's been long overdue. And you were just a summer fling, like the autumn leaves you change, and the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you. Well, I guess it's time to tell you how I really feel. Well, it feels so bad to lead you along. I remember there was a time back in mid-July when I thought our love was everything but wrong. Starting now, I'm tired of pretending it's been long overdue. And you were just a summer fling, like the autumn leaves you changed, and the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you.
Tonight. How about got tonight's music by the Salty Dogs. Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and you can hear more at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Tonight's show is benefiting the Arkansas Chug-a-Bugs, and I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? This week's stories are all about great adventures, either planned or unplanned. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Julia Knoll thinks she's going on a low-key youth trip, but fate has other plans in store. And we'll end the night with Alan Reese as he steps into the sultry heat of the Big Easy and everything changes. But let's start the night with Alan Eastham as he faces the infamous river monster in Central Virginia in Meeting the Monster.
The scoutmaster had to work that weekend, so I was in charge of the scouts who were about to float the Maury River in Central Virginia. One of them, let's call him Brian, pulled on my sleeve. He was pale. His voice was trembling, and he said, "I'm not going." Now, we had just watched the outfitter's video about the run, and much was made of the river monster, a rock that made a standing wave, dead center in a narrow, fast-flowing stretch of the river between a 90-degree right-hand turn and a 90-degree left-hand turn, placed just so to ensure you were on it before you had about 5 seconds to think about it. This monster, the outfitter dramatized, would suck you down and maybe spit you out. He said many, many canoes had come to grief on meeting this malevolent and material spirit of the river. Brian was a reedy little fella in his first year of Boy Scouts, making him 12 years old tops. Now, when they're 12, you have to watch them to make sure they don't do dangerous little kid stuff. For the younger scouts, a good day's work involves hitting a tree or another scout with a stick. This is not like the older scouts, who are mostly capable and can often be relied upon to do the right thing, including putting up your tent, starting the fire, and cooking dinner. But this little fellow was on his second or third camping trip, seemed very attached to his absent dad, and obviously hadn't spent much time away from home. The other dozen scouts, all of them older than Brian, were already on the bus, life jackets on and paddles in hand. But Brian was on strike. No way was he going someplace where there was a river monster whose sole purpose in being was to drag him to the bottom. What to do? The only thing I could think of was to do something loco, as in loco parentis. I said, "Brian, you're in the canoe with me. We'll take this thing together." I handed him a paddle and a life jacket and hustled him onto the bus. Now, I'm not the best canoe hand in the world. I can tip a canoe over by sneezing or even thinking about sneezing. But my objective was to get the trip going, and to do that, I had to put on my grown-up leader attitude and pretend that we were not going to be dragged under by the river monster, all the while thinking about how uncomfortable it was going to be when I got wet. Brian spent the bus trip fretting about having allowed himself to be bullied by a non-parental adult into doing something his best judgment told him was going to be fatal or at best result in serious injury. We launched without incident, and on the way down the river, Brian stretched his neck out at every turn, looking for that monster. I had never before, nor have I since, heard the variations on "Are We There Yet?" that I heard that day. They emerged at every little bend, and I had certainly never heard the scared, quivering vocal tone in which they were delivered. It took us about 2 hours to get to the fateful juncture, and when we finally came around that first bend, there it was, a hump in the water with a short drop-off downstream. Brian was strangely quiet. I wasn't. "Paddle, Brian, paddle!" I said that to the frozen-up child, who it turned out was paralyzed by fear and who was staring over the front of the canoe at that wave. He never hit a lick. The suddenly rapid current turned the canoe sideways, and the river monster ate us for lunch. We dipped sideways left upstream, sideways right downstream, and then the canoe capsized and we went swimming. Brian knew what to do. He had obviously paid attention to the safety aspects of that stupid video. He grabbed the canoe and held on for dear life. I could have done without the commentary. "It's dragging me down, it's dragging me down," as we drifted into slack water at the bank on the next turn. I could also have done without the hysterical laughing fit from the rest of the troop, who had all stopped in the second curve to watch the monster devour somebody. Brian and I seemed to have been the only ones for whom the monster had an appetite that day, and the pent-up frustration of a dozen Boy Scouts, average age 14, believing they'd been denied, the intense pleasure of seeing someone tump over their canoe and be swallowed up by Jonah, burst forth in a single roar. There were scouts rolling on the riverbank, uncontrollable mirth, and I swear at least three of them fell into the river. We emptied the water out of the canoe, got back in it, and proceeded, wet, on down the river. After about 10 minutes, Brian turned around and looked at me. A big smile emerged from the previously terrified kid, and he said, "Can we do that again tomorrow?" Now, this transformation was more than a little disconcerting. I had gotten used to the other Brian, the one who had been emanating profound terror and fear of the unknown from all his pores all afternoon. Gone was the mortal dread. Gone was the fear of some unknown, semi-animated underwater creature that might snatch him from the land of the living and remove him from the bosom of his family, his soccer team, and his comfortable suburban existence forever. And he had survived, and even if the truth be known, had enjoyed that little canoe toss into the river. We did indeed do it again the next day. This time he paddled, and we didn't have to swim. I haven't seen him since we moved away from Virginia 7 years ago. He should be well along in college by now. I hope he's still conquering his monsters and still preparing to take them on a second time for fun.
Alan Eastham teaches foreign policy at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas. Earlier, he was in the U.S. Foreign Service, mostly in Africa and Asia. He wound up as a U.S. ambassador to Malawi and then Congo. In our next story, Julia Knoll's youth trip quickly deteriorates, and that's just looking for their hotel room in What Happens in Oklahoma City.
We rolled into the Oklahoma City motel parking lot around midnight, the precise moment that the apocalypse decided to hit. I was on my church youth group's mother-daughter trip, and we were welcomed with thunder, rain, and a strong sense of impending disaster. In the whirlwind mix of absolute darkness and thickening precipitation, we had no idea where our rooms might be in this foreign concrete labyrinth. My friend Elizabeth and I naively volunteered to attempt locating the three rooms we would be dividing into. Kicking off my toms, their safety was the important thing here, Elizabeth and I leapt out of the van. It didn't take much aimless running to realize our seemingly gallant action was really, really stupid. Leaning over the rails that lined the second story walkway, I pretended to know exactly what I was looking for. Mostly I was just thinking, hey, Titanic, but with more rain. It was the same general feeling of imminent watery death. Elizabeth turned to me and yelled, struggling to raise her voice over the downpour. What were the room numbers? I thought you were supposed to remember them. We did our best to backtrack to the van, my bare feet and her soaking Converse slapping against the slick concrete. Wait, where was the van? It appeared that instead of us leaving them, they had left us, giving up on the tiny faith they had in our navigational abilities, or lack thereof. It didn't take long for us to come up with a strategy. Frantically scrambling around the metal staircases and open walkways was obviously the most intelligent thing to do. Lightning danced across the sky, and rain was beginning to look a lot heavier than rain should look. Also, it was coming at us sideways. Rain doesn't do that normally, if you haven't noticed. Right as Elizabeth yelled something at me, it sounded a lot like, "I got hail up my nose." Sirens cut through the air. The little plop noises water makes turned into the rattling of ice beating against metal. Someone started yelling their names, and we turned to see a mom that had come on the trip frantically waving her arms at us. They had managed to find two of the rooms, and everyone was taking cover in there. The cable had gone out, and they were having a difficult time removing the poltergeist-esque pattern from the television, and there was no room so far. And I went out again, this time with high school student Libby, to find our last room. Conveniently took very little time to find it. We remembered the numbers this time. And even less time to notice the unmade beds and a beer can on the window. We didn't really want to investigate that matter further. Back in the crowded lobby and increasingly damp room where we had all gathered, Libby's mom phoned the lobby. They would have loved to be in assistance, but the lobby was flooding, and they were just a bit busy at the moment. Libby and her mom went out to get their things from the van and find another motel. By then, we were all ready to turn in. It was well past our bedtimes, and the whole experience of arriving was hectic enough. But where was all of our stuff? The van, of course. Silly us, thinking that we could relax. And guess who went to get the suitcases and makeup bags? Two others accompanied me on this adventure, and we managed to haul most of the stuff in one trip. A couple others went back for the extras we had left. Needless to say, we got a good night's sleep, except for the tornado sirens at 4 a.m, but whatever. In the morning, we had a lovely breakfast and left for the actual event we had come for, the Revolve Tour, which was great. Hilarious speakers, awesome music, great message. It was all fun. We were pretty tired by the time we got back to the motel, which was around 8. Of course, we had to drive around the police motorcycles in a paddy wagon. As to not arouse suspicion, we quietly and quickly slipped into our rooms. Church mother-daughter trips are unbelievably conspicuous, after all. I eavesdropped through the very thin door as our group leader talked to one of the many officers outside. "Is there anything we should be concerned about?" "No, ma'am, just a frat party that got a little out of control." He paused. "Are y'all with a cheerleading group or something?" "No, actually, we're here for a church event." She seems to stress those last two words. "Then why'd you choose this hotel?" Criminal hotspots were suitable for cheer teams, but certainly not much else, according to this policeman. That's when I saw it, out the window down in the parking lot, a girl getting arrested. I closed the blinds and stepped back into the room. This wasn't my business. I grabbed the camera. This was everybody's business. And in HD glory, I caught the whole experience, adding my own thorough narration of the event, until Miss Beth, the mom on the trip, opened the door. "Management said they're out of towels because of the flood," she declared as she thrust a misshapen, off-white pile onto a bed. "But they gave me hand towels and bath mats. They said they think they're clean." After she left, we wondered aloud what else could happen to this. Nothing, right? Even the van ride back home, countless morbid mafia games and all, couldn't be as weird as what happened up until this point. The universe seemed to think that needed disproving, though, because pretty soon after that, there was a knock at the door. Peering through the peephole, Julia, my name buddy, who was experiencing this as her first youth trip, yelled, "It's the cops!" It would take a lot of explaining to convince her that this stuff didn't happen all the time. "I don't have any pants," I protested. My lime green pajama shorts could hardly be considered underwear, really. I barrel rolled behind a bed and pulled on a large hoodie as my mom opened the door. "Excuse me, ma'am, how are you affiliated with this black Mercedes in the parking lot?" I quickly pulled out my book. Ironically enough, it was The Return of Sherlock Holmes. Maybe I hadn't done anything, but innocent people get arrested every year, right? "We're not, actually, with a church group, in a church van," my mom said, adding that last part quickly. "Are you sure? Do you know anything concerning this car?" "Oh no, we're not sure that we drove a church van for hours to get to this hotel, which floods and doesn't have towels, and is full of people trying to interrogate us. I'm gonna have to rethink that one." "Yes, and we don't know anything about it. Thank you." He left them and Mom shut the door, separating us from the chaos that was quietly ongoing outside. We burst into hysterics then. Maybe it was the lack of sleep, maybe because it was so late at night, or maybe because the insanity of everything that happened to us over that ridiculous span of 48 hours was getting to us. As I rolled onto the bed laughing, I found it hard to imagine that another church youth trip would top this one. But hey, I was willing to give it a shot.
Julia Knoll will be in the 8th grade at Bethel Middle School in Bryant, Arkansas in the fall. She hopes to someday be a photographer for National Geographic, or she might try her hand at world domination. In our final story of the night, Alan Reese goes to Jazz Fest and Let's Go, and the music takes him away in Walking the Second Line.
It was my first visit to the Big Easy. I was a gray-haired man walking and sweating and not caring, gulping cold beer, and listening like tens of thousands of others as I wandered through the musical tents of the Jazz Fest. Everywhere was the sound of jazz and blues and rock and zydeco. Guitars strutted and posed. Long wooden sticks punished drums. An incredibly young trumpet player pushed breath into a mouthpiece, and I watched beautiful brass notes exit. The music and the crowds and the heat began to draw out ancient memories, herbal aromas, and the unexpected sparks of an exploding seed. Tie-dye shirts, lighters, bare feet, flowers, and dark eyes. I remembered knowing that Grace Slick was a goddess and that Janis Joplin was a living hurricane that could push her soul into tens of thousands like me. I remember feeling this is why one lives. But that hadn't been the corporeal me for decades. Not really. That me, that old unheard and unseen me, mostly floated quietly, circling inside, waiting. I listened and felt the heat and the music form a wisp that coaxed and whispered. Those old memories began to stretch. They coalesced and began to move to the light. That old me awoke and joined the crowd, clapping, stomping, moving, whistling, yelling. No one cared about the heat or the sweat. Some sounds were new to me, and I could sense rumbling and stacking as new memories began to form. But the old sounds, that old music was different. Huge roars met guitar riffs. Thousands began to sing lyrics, remembered and loved. No one cared if your voice was absurdly mellifluous, pretentious, loud, squeaky, or simply non-existent. No one cared if you just moved your lips with hollow syllables because you weren't sure. There were more tents and more music and more, more heat and bits of gumbo with andouille than a soft-shelled crab whose existence ended wearing hot sauce between chunks of bread. More beer and slaloms of sweat, and then my companion's insistence on one more tent for the Big Easy Virgin, the tent for those who had never walked the second line, like me. Walk the second line, I asked. What is that second line? Why would we not walk the first? Come, they said. You will learn, you will walk, and you will love it. Will I sweat more? You will, they laughed, and still you will love it. We know you. I trusted them, and we approached, the music sounding dirge-like, but not of an end, more a start. Long arms sliding brass bones, three-keyed cons with puffed-out cheeks, a sensually curved alto, and a licorice reed all rooted in the primal loam of a gleaming black-holed bass, a New Orleans brass band. But in person, the sound coming to me personally, from instrument to my body, encompassing me, moving my hair, and demanding something from me. Music not from a speaker, with knobs to adjust minutely, to replay, to re-sleeve, to reshelf, and forget for months. This was music imperfect, fading and welling, personal and immediate. I watched wide-eyed and listened and became enchanted. This was more than a band and an audience of individuals. A mass wisp caressed the tent and absorbed it. It pushed the walls gently out and spilled through the doors to crowding outsiders. The aisles filled with feathers, umbrellas, little bits of waving cloth, long skirts, shorts, sandals. I saw squared sideburns, birthmarks, polo shirts, gnarled hands, and lovely limbs. They began to walk through the music, step, 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 step. I looked at my companions. They smiled and pointed, the second line. I could feel demands disappearing, unhappy jobs, car trouble, money woes, broken loves, aches. Deadlines went away, sickness was put aside. The world in its hideousness was fading, all of it, save the calling brass of the first line and the stepping mass of the second. Step, step. Sidestep, sidestep, step, step. A morbidly obese elderly man stepped with an equally aged, gray-haired, thin woman. A tall, bearded man with a stroke rictus of a smile stepped stiffly, awkwardly, with an umbrella carefully held. Only his happy eyes reflected a graceful inner dance. A grandmother stepped and carried a young child, following a tall young man with hooded eyes and a torn shirt. A middle-aged woman with a flowered shirt and a straw boater followed. Three young women stepped and sidestepped. They moved with beautiful, overt sensuality, but they weren't right. No, they weren't right, and it suggested that at its deep level, the second line is primal, but not hormonal. They were lovely and alluring. Their movement was youthful, sensual, happy, but it was the movement of promise, not release. I stood step-stepping in place, listening with yesterday and tomorrow slipping away. The line grew. It followed colorful through aisles, seething and vibrating with steppers of grace, rhythm, awkwardness, clumsiness. Yet no sex, no race, no age. I stood step-stepping in place, and all of the reasons I had gathered over my life to keep me seated in the face of music and movement and watchers were suddenly foolish. I knew that I was the only human being on earth that cared what I would look like. I stood stepping in place, knowing that when I emerge, I will be one of them, no matter if I crawl. So I left my standing place and companions, even in the a bit unwilling to completely suppress ego, mentally reviewing the relationship of step to beat, movement to rhythm. I stepped in behind a short gray-haired man with a ponytail, a red shirt, and a waving umbrella, and I began my best imitation of the Addams Family butler. Within six steps, I truly didn't care. The wisp was relentless and rhythmic and encompassing. I followed the colors and textures and rippling bits of cloth. A seated woman shook her shoulders and touched my hand. Umbrellas moved up and down and circled in colored arcs. Still images of hats with sequins, sundresses, a Grand Canyon t-shirt, buttons, salt and pepper hair. Smiles and comfortable faces came and went, and stepping seemed natural. Over it all was the music and the heat, and over all that was something. I cannot find the word. I believe it does not exist. To say happiness or joy or even the absurdly clinical collective obsessional behavior is to invite personal impression. But this wasn't an experience to draw on or enhance or concentrate anyone's feelings. It was meant to release them, to ban them, all of them. The past and the future were irrelevant to the moment. All one should have is a tabula rasa, a mind emptied and existing solely to hear, to feel the wisp, and to walk. So that is what I did. I shushed my irascible and vocal knees, emptied my mind, and I listened and felt and stepped. Around the tent, and again. Then it was over. The brass notes faded, umbrellas closed, and little bits of cloth were tucked away. The eyes of second liners met and paused. Instruments clicked into cases, and it ended. Hell, it can't last, you know. It shouldn't last. The value of such a moment is in its fleeting nature. There is no anticipation for something that never departs. So I began to refill and began to think of heat and cold beer and gumbo, but floating quietly, now waiting patiently deep within, was something new. So I said to my companions, it's going to be a long walk to the car.
Retired and transplanted to the South, Alan Reese has summited difficult mountains and then wept with emotion and exhaustion, tied cherry stems into granny knots with his tongue, and most importantly, has kept every friend he ever made. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.